Okay, so here I am recording on the iRiver from my living room on Centra with my video on digital rights management on the afternoon of January the 11th. The way I'll proceed is I'll talk for a little bit and then I'll pause. You'll find that I pause fairly frequently. I'll actually turn off the speaking icon, and if you have any questions or comments or interjections of any sort to make at that time, I'll just ask you to jump in during those pauses. Here's an example of one of my pauses. And as you can see, there's enough time for you to jump in, I'm not sure whether participants can just jump in or not, or whether they have to raise their hand, but I'll let somebody else manage that because I'll be talking. But there is time to just jump in during those pauses. That was another pause. And see, we'll get used to the system. I've found when I'm presenting online that it's really, really easy to just run away with things, and because there's nobody there really to say stop. So you sort of really have to build that in. The topic of this talk is digital rights management. This is the first thing. And again, we'll do RSS much more informally later. And I'm going to cover DRM in four basic sections. I'm going to talk about the concept in general to begin with, and then I'll talk about each of the three major aspects of the concept in general, expression, authentication, and protection. Now, probably not necessary, but I'll have to begin talking a bit about what digital rights management, or as some people call it, digital restrictions management, really is. And really, it boils down to a very simple concept, and that concept is, first of all, to express usage rights, copyrights or play rights, etc., associated with digital content, and then secondly, in some cases, to apply or to enforce those rights. You'll notice the pauses also often are associated with changes of slides. Now, as I mentioned just a few seconds ago, this really breaks down into three major aspects. Now, first of all is the expression of the right. Description of the resource sometimes, an indication of who owns the resource, and an indication of what the terms and conditions are for use. Second aspect is authentication, the verification of the user's identity and whether that user has rights to use the object. And then third, and this is the part that everybody talks about, some sort of protection, a means such as encryption or locking to control access to a resource. Now, if you think about it, we can apply digital rights management in three major areas. One area, obviously, is the resource itself, and this is something that we're actually fairly familiar with. The resource may be a document or a file, and we can apply DRM by locking that document, requiring password access, or even encrypting the document. We can also apply DRM at the access point, that is to say, the place where we get the document. We might, for example, require a login or some other authentication to get into a content repository. So the access point management is applied at the content server or on the database where the resource is stored. And then third, we might apply DRM to the entire network. The use of the network as a whole would require some sort of authentication. Now, if we think of it, we can look at these three things in a metric. We have the expression, the authentication, and the protection of the resource and the rights. And then we have the location, the resource, or the access point, or the network as a whole. And different types of DRM are instances of different locations and different types of DRM expression or management. You look, for example, a digital rights expression applied to a resource only might be a copyright notice. Or to access, it might be a terms of use notice on a website, for example, or a piece of software. Or for the network as a whole, it might be a rights expression language. And similarly, if we look at protection as applied to a resource, that might be an encrypted document. Or to access the secure sockets layer, that's what you have when you access a website with the HTTPS protocol. Or the VPN for network-wide protection. Essentially, what this metric does is it allows us to define degrees of digital rights management. We can talk about digital rights management being stronger, going from the very weak form, which is expression, to the very strong form, which is some sort of protection. And we can talk about digital rights management being more pervasive, going from the resource-based DRM through to the network-based DRM. Weak digital rights management essentially consists of expression in the resource only. There's no authentication, there's no protection. And you might think, that could never work. But it can work. If you look at, for example, a web page with a copyright notice, or even more commonly, a book with a copyright page, or property with a keep out sign. These are all examples of weak digital rights management, or well, I guess in the case of the property, it's not digital rights management, but it's still the same sort of thing. By contrast, we can have strong DRM, where the expression may be anywhere and is probably everywhere, in the resource, the access point, or in the network, where there's an authentication process, a single login, and protection is network-wide. Good example is the ATM system for automated banking, very strong DRM, and interestingly, we want strong DRM there, but also virtual private networks, or to use the property analogy again, a gated community where there's a big fence with iron rails outside the community and a guard that prevents you from going in, and then even when you do go in, there's keep out signs all over the place, and you know, this house patrolled by armed dogs, and then locks on the front doors and all of that. When you look at, and there has been a lot of discussion about digital rights management, of course, in the media. I was reading even today in the newspaper today about pending legislation coming from our current governments about digital rights management. You could see instances of these arguments. You look at the arguments, you see two major types of argument. On the one hand, you hear from content providers an argument to the effect that DRM is too weak. In digital networks like the World Wide Web or peer-to-peer networks like Napster or Nutella, expression of rights alone is insufficient to ensure that rights are respected. Or another way of putting it, copying is rampant. On the other hand, people who are opposed to DRM argue that DRM is too strong. We propose DRM systems that require a unique user ID such as Microsoft Passport. Who wants to sign over their life to Passport? And you need this fully secured network, rights management servers, trusted application. You have to give them your blood type, your mother's married name, and swear on your dog's life that you are who you say you are. The argument is that these violate privacy. They violate fair use. In my own thinking, I've come to support what might be called a middle way on digital rights management. And this middle way is a recognition that although as much as I would like all content to be free, not all content will be free, it's a bit more than mere expression, but it's a long way away from, you know, the strong enforcement of DRM. Expression of digital rights is supported at the network level in this middle way through the use of a rights expression language. Authentication is supported at the access level through the use of what are called tickets. I have called them keys in previous documents, but probably the better expression to use is the word tickets. And then finally, protection, if any, and I would argue that for the most part you don't really need any, protection would be supported only at the document level with whatever sorts of locks or encryption accompany that content format. Yes and no. I mean, it's going to depend a lot on what sort of technology you're using. Your typical web page, for example, can include content from all over the place, all over the world, in fact, and all kinds of different content. And yet, all of that is virtually seamless from the point of view of the user. You click on a URL, that takes you to an HTML page, and then the HTML takes care of rounding up the rest of the resources, and then players embedded within your browser take care of displaying the resource on your screen. And there's nothing to say that a DRM layer can't operate in that sort of environment. On the other hand, it can be very difficult if you get situations where, for example, to use the web analogy, if people say, well, you can never embed one of our resources in any other resource. You see that fairly often with museum artifacts, museum digital artifacts. The New York, I think it was New York Public Library, created a real nice site with all kinds of resources in that and made them all available, but you can't copy them, you can't link to them, you can't use them at all. And so the use of those resources in any sort of complex setting is going to become very cumbersome. So really, that's why I say yes and no. It's going to depend how you set it up. I'm going to talk a bit about that and talk a bit about how to set it up through the course of this discussion. And so we can return to that question. We can say, well, what I'm describing, is that going to be easy to set up? So I want to begin with digital rights expression, and again, expression, digital rights expression is a description of the rights associated with a digital object. And out there in the world, we've got two major standards, naturally we've got two major standards, of digital rights expression. We've got, on the one hand, the Open Digital Rights Language, which is an independent initiative. It's an open source initiative. You can use it without paying royalties, and it has in fact been adopted by the Open Mobile Alliance. So it is a going concern. People really do use it, and ODRL is on ODRL version 2 right now. And opposed to that, and literally opposed to that, is MPEG REL. REL standing for Rights Expression Language. It used to be called XRML. It's proprietary. It's owned by a company called Content Guard. Content Guard has investors in it like Microsoft and Thomson, the big content type companies. And what they would like to do is charge people royalties, not for the use of the language, but for the use or the creation of technology that interprets the language. Content Guard owns patents regarding digital rights languages. And essentially the patents are for the expression of rights in a language. And we've been talking a lot about the Blackboard patent recently. This patent predates it has been around for a number of years and has caused, in my view, nothing but problems in the whole area of rights expression, because it has basically prevented the deployment internet-wide of a rights expression scheme. What a rights expression will do is describe the major features of digital rights as they apply to some given object. And if you look at this rights expression model, this is from a paper by Renato Iannella, who is the author of ODRL. You can look at three aspects of conditions governing the use of an object. The obligation, for example, whether you have to pay, whether you have to provide tracking, whether you've earned loyalty points. The constraints, how many times can you play something? What place can you play something? And then the usage permissions, what you can do. Can you play it? Can you print it? Can you reuse it? And then all of these, in turn, are owned by various rights holders. Now, basically, what a rights expression language will do is it will take stuff like this, and there's more involved in this because we want to describe the resource itself, we want to describe who owns the resource and how we know they are who they are, and we want to describe who is being given permission to use the resource. We take all of these things, and basically the idea is they get expressed in an XML document. There are actually a number of different types of rights expressions that can come up. Here are four, and there's two more on the next slide, defined by ODRL 2.0. Might be a simple statement of rights. For example, a copyright notice is a simple statement of rights. No people are involved. It's just simply terms of use. You know, you can, cannot copy something. Could be an offer. Especially in a lot of contractual situations, you may have something for sale and you express the conditions under which you would make something available to somebody, to a purchaser. So an offer isn't a statement of existing rights, however, it's a statement of rights that could, under certain circumstances, be applied. The offer, of course, is a prelude to an agreement, where you have a statement of conditions. Those conditions are agreed upon by two parties. Agreement could also be reached as a result of a request or a demand. Well, I don't want to say demand because you never get away with that. A request, an indication of a desire to obtain some rights or to use some resource in some particular way. Another type of rights expression is called the ticket, and again, this is what I used to call the key. What the ticket is a token that allows access to or use of a resource. And if you think of a ticket to get into a hockey game, it's pretty much the same sort of thing. Or if, you know, imagine you have one of those get a free CD, right? And they give you a little ticket. Well, I can use video. They give you a little ticket, and you take your ticket and you go down to the CD store. You present the ticket. They give you a CD. Money is kind of like a ticket. And then finally, offer and transfer rights expressions. And these are rights expressions that actually may transfer the ownership, or more commonly, transfer other rights, transfer the right to grant rights to an object. So I might have a book, and then I grant you, the reseller, the right to sell access to that book to third parties. Now, in practical terms, and we want to stay in practical terms, people aren't going to be managing the rights or the rights expressions to their own objects, at least not unless, you know, they're very large publishers or something like that. And so typically what's going to happen, and this was the core of the proposal that we at NRC did as part of the EduSource project, is a broker mechanism whereby you have a broker called a vendor broker, which is a service that helps vendors create rights metadata and that stores and serves that rights metadata on request. And in addition, the vendor broker may conduct transactions on behalf of the vendor. For example, they may be one of these credit card agencies that receives money, and then they may in turn provide tokens or keys or tickets for access to a resource. PayPal is a pretty good example of that, especially on the side of conducting transactions, like accepting payments on behalf of the vendor. I'm not sure if PayPal provides tickets for access to resources, but suppose you had a mechanism whereby you provided PayPal with, you paid PayPal some money, and then what you got in return from PayPal was a specialized URL. Right, and now this URL, it might have a code embedded in it, then grants you access to a digital resource. I know there are services like that. If you go to James Seabury's website, I forget what it is, Sheba Records is what it's called. You don't actually have to pay anything, so you can really experiment with the system. It's kind of nice. And what it does is you put in your purchase order, and then it provides you with these URLs, and you can click on the URL, and that grants you access to the resource. And the way it works is the URL is a ticket because it will allow you only a certain number of accesses. And on Seabury's site, it gives you 5 tries to download the file. And so it's not a URL in the traditional sense where, it will be harvested by Google, anybody can use it. It's really a specialized access to a given resource. The other part of it, the part of creating rights metadata and providing rights metadata, PayPal doesn't do that at all. So far as I know, nobody does it. Nobody does it specifically in that way. There is a service out there which you've probably heard of called Creative Commons. Now, if you think about it, Creative Commons is a vendor broker for people who don't want to receive money. So they only do the first part of it. And what they will do is they provide rights metadata in the form of Creative Commons licenses. And the licenses are actually stored on the Creative Commons website. And then you, as the owner or vendor of some content, will place in your document a reference to that license. And if you go out there on the World Wide Web, you'll see these little Creative Commons buttons on web pages. You click on the Creative Commons button and it goes to the Creative Commons website. And that's what I mean by that. That's then the reference to the license. And so a full-fledged vendor broker would combine all of these services, right? It would allow you to create your license, whether it's a Creative Commons license or something more detailed expressed in ODRL. And it would allow you to put a reference to that license inside your document or inside your document metadata. And then if somebody based on that license wanted to purchase that item, it would conduct the transaction and it would produce the ticket enabling access. It does to a certain extent. I'm not sure what online mechanisms they have, and part of the reason why I'm not sure is because I'm not aware of any mechanism whereby access copyright would work with individuals as opposed to institutions. I know it works with the institutions like colleges and universities and that, but I'm not sure I as a a given individual can sign or work within the parameters of access copyright. Perhaps, but that said, I haven't investigated it in any particular detail, so I can't say for sure. Yeah, that's just it. I mean, I've not seen any mechanism where you can just give them some money and get a resource or anything like that, which is really what you would want in a vendor broker. And as far as I know, Access Copyright, again, will only sell in bulk to institutions. You know, they'll sell a bulk access, the bulk license to all of the content that they provide to a university in that, and then the university will record what content they actually use, say, copying or whatever, and then that will be the basis for the payment. But you can't just go there and say, well, I want to buy one copy of so-and-so's photograph from Access Copyright. I don't think they provide anything remotely like that. Here's a pictorial representation of the system I've just described. You as a vendor, are you able to, oh no, wait, I should have a pen. Here we go. You as the vendor create a resource, and when you create the resource, you create the rights model. And what that means, in effect, is that you create an XML file describing the rights associated with that resource. Now, like the creation of RSS or other XML, you probably wouldn't create that file by hand by yourself, but rather you would access a service hosted by your vendor broker that would create the XML file for you. Then you would send the metadata associated with your resource out there into the world. Basically, typically you'd create an RSS file, or if you're an educational institution, you might create a learning objects metadata file, or if you're a publisher, you might create a Dublin core file, and you create metadata, and you send that out into the world, and inside that metadata is a pointer to the rights model. So your metadata knows what your rights model is. Then out there in the world, there's a consumer that finds your metadata and decides, oh yeah, that looks good, we want to use that content. And so the consumer at that point will ask for the rights model. Remember, the metadata that they've consumed only points to the rights model. So the consumer will ask for the rights model, and then the broker will send the rights model to the consumer. And then the consumer, if they accept the rights model, will request and be granted a ticket for access to the resource from the vendor. Now the idea here in a system such as this, and we're rapidly moving towards such a system, I've already described the Jane Seabury website, which is it's fairly typical. There may be many vendor brokers. Large providers may be their own vendor brokers, or Jane Seabury may be her own vendor broker, and small providers may access a vendor broker service. And vendor brokers will typically receive payments and forward money in lump sums. So you get, you know, it's like, what's the name of that online store? Cafe Press. Cafe Press will sell cups and articles of clothing, t-shirts and things like that with your logo on them. And then after each month, they'll send you a statement and some money. You know, you sold 3 t-shirts, you now have $4 in royalties coming to you. Similarly, these online book selling services such as Lulu.com do a similar sort of thing. We've sold 5 copies of your book. Congratulations, you now get $1.25 in royalties or whatever it is. I talked about Creative Commons as an example of a vendor broker. Creative Commons has a set of rights models. The rights models include the commercial or non-commercial, request for attribution or non-attribution, and the share-alike or non-share-alike, and then more recently to the choice to allow consumers to create derivatives out of your work or not. You make your choice of a license from Creative Commons, and then Creative Commons will provide you with a pointer or a reference to the location of that rights model on their website, and then you put that pointer or reference either in your own metadata, such as your RSS file, or your own resource, such as your web page. And customers can ask to see the rights model. For example, they'll click on the Creative Commons link, and once they see the model, then they can determine whether or not they have permission to use the resource. There's another example, Amazon.com. You can use Amazon.com to set the terms of purchase. The purchasers can obtain the terms of purchase from Amazon. Purchasers can make payments directly to Amazon, and then Amazon will in turn pay the vendor. So that was rights expression, but when you move beyond rights expression and move toward a more stringent type of digital rights management, then we move into the wonderful world of authentication. And this, it may seem like a separate topic from digital rights management, but you'll find that it's not. You'll find that you don't do digital rights management without authentication. Well, you can, you know, like in the Creative Commons type model, but typically there's going to be some kind of authentication involved, particularly for any sort of access which requires payment or restrictions on access or conditions or things like that. It's also a morass. And again, like the matter of rights expression language in general, there are many issues that remain open on the web, and then there are factions arguing back and forth. I want to begin discussing authentication by making a distinction between identification and authentication, where identification is the act of claiming an identity, and in a special case, self-identification, the act of claiming an identity for oneself. For example, if I say, I am Stephen Downs, that is an act of self-identification. And to contrast that with authentication, which is an act of verifying an identity claim, where the verification establishes that the identity claim, the signal or the sign, in fact does signify the entity. If I say, I am Stephen Downs to the police officer, that's an identity claim. If the police officer looks at my license, sees the picture of me on my license next to the name Stephen Downs, that's authentication. There are different ways of making identity claims. The most common way is the simple assertion. I make a claim that I am so-and-so. I might say my name, or I might sign my name to a document, or I might key my personal identification number into an ATM. These are all cases of me making a claim about myself. You might think, well, a PIN number, no, that's not a claim. But of course it is a claim. It's me typing something that is secret to myself, but nonetheless is me making a claim to the bank that I am so-and-so. These assertions very frequently will be accompanied by tokens. A token is a physical object, the possession of which is typically unique to the person making the claim. A driver's license, for example, is a token. It's an actual physical object. And what will make it unique to the bearer is that it'll have a picture of the a picture of the person on the license. It'll have a signature on the license, and of course the name. Sometimes tokens may contain a reference only to the bearer and not to a given individual. Money, for example, says pay to the bearer of this note. Money is a token. Or a ticket to a hockey game is a token. Tickets in general are tokens. Now, where things get tricky is where some people want to claim one thing and other people demand other things. And recently, the discussion has come down to the question of what is being claimed. Is it being claimed when you make an identity claim that you are what they call a principal? A principal technically is a person that is represented by a broker. So a principal, in effect, is a specific person. If you make a claim that you are a principal, you are making a claim that you are a certain individual person. That the identity claim that you're making has a one-to-one relationship with that person. When I say, for example, I am Stephen Downs, what I'm saying is not, oh, I'm one of the many Stephen Downses that wanders around the world. No, rather what I'm saying is, I am the Stephen Downs. Now, of course, that's a bit tricky when there are, in fact, other Stephen Downses. So I need to use things like my social insurance number. And so if I make an identity claim to the government, I say, I am for da 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 da. In a lot of cases, though, we won't claim to be a principal. We will claim simply to be an identity. That is to say, not necessarily a certain person, but rather some person that has certain properties. What kind of properties, for example? Well, the property of having a ticket. If I make a claim of an identity claim with a ticket, all I am claiming is I have the ticket. If I'm logging on with a user ID and a password, that's an identity claim. It's not a principal claim, because I can log on to the same site with more than one identity. Now, the reason why this is significant, in my view, is because identity claims are basically all you're going to get. And the way this works, the reasoning is that authentication claims to test for identities as principals will in the end fail. Now, let's think about it. Authentication is either one of two things. It's either the testimony of some person or some agency that you are so-and-so, or it's the presentation by you of some evidence to that effect. Now, if you think about it, this reduces to the presentation of some evidence to that effect, because you have to ask, well, in the case of the testimony, you ask, well, how did they know that you are who you are? Well, you must have at some point proven to them that you are who you are. And the same proof that you would have given to them is the same proof that you can give in the current circumstance. So the testimony of some person really is just a proxy for the actual presentation of some artifact, some evidence at some point in time. Now, okay, so we have the presentation of some artifact that is in some way, presumably, knowingly unique to the person, and also, which attests, as they say, to the truth of the statement that I am so-and-so. Again, the classic case is the presentation of a driver's license, right? That's an artifact. You present the driver's license, and then the driver's license is knowably unique to me because on the driver's license, there is a picture of me. And presumably, I am the only person who looks like me. I've been told that. Actually, I've been told the opposite. I've been told that I have clones. I have clones almost in pretty much every country in the world. It's kind of weird. The thing is, there's no such thing in the digital world. In the case of the offline world, if you think about how this works, right, you're presenting yourself, that is to say, your body, and a token, and the token is in some way related to your body in a way that's instantly verifiable. But in the online world, there is no body to present. All you have is the token. And I know some people are going to be saying, biometrics. Well, yeah, but from the point of view of the receiver, what you are receiving is some message corresponding to the testimony of some device that some biometric measure has been satisfied. But from the point of view of the receiver, you don't have the body. You have to trust in the system at the other end that verified that that was the body. And if the system at the other end is in the hands of the person that is asking to be trusted, then it is by that fact not trustworthy. Now what we've seen is the use of proxies, because you can use a proxy, or you can know about a proxy at the other end. There are three major types: IP-based authentication. Each computer logs on to the internet with a more or less unique internet address. Or processor-based authentication. Each CPU in a computer has a unique signature. And this signature can be presented as an address. If it's an Ethernet card, that address is known as a MAC address. And you find yourself having to confirm your MAC address sometimes when you sign on to a university network. Or in the realm of Microsoft Vista and similar sorts of things, trusted computing, where there's a portion of the computer memory that is inaccessible to the user and is therefore quote unquote trusted by the person at the other end. Now all of these things are ways of associating an identity claim not with a person, but rather with a specific piece of hardware. Now, when you think about it, ask yourself, what makes the ATM network secure? Because if you think about it, a lot of this stuff just doesn't apply on an ATM network. You want to get cash from a bank machine, you give them your card, that's the presentation of a token, you type in your number, that's self-identification, and the thing spits out some cash. Simple. From the point of view of the bank machine, if you're sitting in the back of the bank machine, all you get is a digital representation of a card and a signature, your PIN number. So all you get is digital information. And yet that works. And the reason why it works is you have a motivation to authenticate correctly. You have a motivation to type in the correct PIN number and the same PIN number every time. And moreover, you have a motivation not to let anybody else type in that PIN number. And that motivation is you want to keep your money. And this is the motivation principle. Self-identification can be trusted if it is in the interest of the self to self-identify accurately. And this is where most cases of digital rights management have failed. There really is no upside for the consumer in digital rights management. I've seen this, you see this written, you know. No consumer group or organization or no consumer out there is demanding that companies make their products less easy to use or harder to access. Nobody's asking for this except the producers. By contrast, if I'm not motivated to protect my identity, I can share my password, my PIN, or whatever. There's an internet site out there called BugMeNot, which basically shares passwords, usernames and passwords for access to websites like the New York Times. Or if I have physical content, I can loan you the book or the CD. You know, if you think about it, you know, all these, you know, MAC addresses and computer-based addresses and even trusted computer, none of that works if I give you the computer. You know, I mean, I have a computer, it's a trusted computer, I can run the game on it. If you want to use the game, sure, here's a computer. Computer, how much is it worth? When you think about it, what authentication does is twofold. It increases the cost of false attribution claims. The whole MAC address thing and the whole trusted computer thing is based on the presumption that I don't want to part with my computer or I don't want to part with my phone, because you get phone number based attribution as well. But if you don't mind sharing your computer or giving it away, then that's fine. And then the second thing is it increases the difficulty of making false attribution claims. It may require that you present specific hardware, or it may require that you access from a specific place. But again, it makes it more difficult, but it doesn't make it impossible. Different types of identity expression have developed on the internet, and there's two major types. The first type is what might be called identity federations. Now, what an identity federation is a closed network whereby the members of that network accept identity claims from each other. Now, sometimes that network might consist of one member. Microsoft Passport is a pretty good example of that, where Microsoft Passport would accept identity claims from Microsoft Passport. And then, of course, what they're going to do is make Passport. Oh, yeah, everybody will use Passport to access everything. Today, what we're seeing is this role being taken over by Google and Yahoo. Those of you who had blogs on Blogger have just gone through this, where your blog has morphed from being a Blogger blog to a Google blog. And what has happened there is not so much that the blog changed, although they made it look like a software switch, right? But rather the identity claim changed, right? Now you're not claiming your identity, your Blogger identity anymore. You're claiming your Google identity. Other networks involve, other federations may involve more than one partner. Good example of that is the Shibboleth Federation. It was actually officially adopted in Britain, and is widely, I don't know if I want to say used, but they all say used as well by colleges and universities in the United States and possibly in Canada, I'm not sure. And a similar sort of thing is the Liberty Alliance, and the Liberty and Shibboleth are interoperable, so you sort of have almost a mega federation. And arguably registry-based services, that is a service that has a list of all the different names of people who are identified, such as LID or SKIP. That's spelled wrong. That should be SXIP. These arguably also fall under the heading of identity federations. It's just they make joining the federation very simple. The thing with a federation is that it's a limited area in which identity claims apply. If you think about the Google identity again, you can use your Google username only on Google properties. You can use your Yahoo username only on Yahoo properties. And in Shibboleth, your Shibboleth identity won't apply outside that particular content federation. It won't apply outside your university network. So you couldn't log on to say, MySpace or YouTube using your Shibboleth identity. They're just completely separate. By contrast, we also have what are being called distributed identities, and in particular OpenID and YADIS, which stands for yet another distributed identity system. And these are kind of like federations that include everybody. They're distributed, which means that there's no single registry of identities. Anybody can make identity claims. And that also is what makes them open. So basically what OpenID is, what YADIS is a self-expression mechanism. In a sense, OpenID or YADIS are essentially automated password fillers. It'll fill in the password for you. I don't know if you can hear the chime of my clock in the background, but it's chiming. We'll just wait that out. It's one of the perils of doing these things from home, but I get so much better bandwidth here. So I developed a system a year or two ago called MIDM, Mighty Me. It's an open ID proposal, but basically what it does is instead of having you type down the location of your identity server, the thing that does the password filling for you, it actually puts that assertion into the browser header. So basically what it does is my browser announces to a website, I am so-and-so, wherever I go. Now what happens is, suppose I'm trying to access some web server. What happens is, I make the request to that server, and I've declared I am so-and-so, and the server says, oh, really? And what it does is it redirects me back to the location that I said was my web server. And what it does is it sends me back not just all by myself, but with some sort of ticket that's unique to the server I'm trying to access. On my web server, I store that ticket. And then my web server sends me back to the original web server. And when I get back, the original web server says, okay, if he's really that person, he should have put the ticket on his website. So it checks, is that ticket there? And it goes, oh yeah, there it is. And if the ticket is there, then it'll send me through. And if not, well, then the authentication fails and it'll send me to a login page. Very simple system. And the idea here is that I don't need to enter passwords or anything else like that. I'm making this identity claim automatically on all the different sites that I go to. This kind of builds some of the motivation, because now you're using this identity to access all of your sites. Now the stakes are a bit higher insofar as keeping the same identity is concerned. There was a paper very recently, just in the last few days, by Dana Boyd, talking about teens and identity. And basically what she said is teens have disposable identities. They sign up to a site, MySpace, whatever, create an identity, do all kinds of stuff, and then abandon it. Why? Well, they forgot the password or whatever. They have no motivation to continue with that identity. They have no motivation to keep it whole, to keep it secure. But if you have one identity that works everywhere, you have motivation to keep it, and you have motivation to keep it yours, to keep it secure, so that only you can log on with that identity. But the thing is, this is self-identification. This is identity, or identification as identity, and not identification as principle, because you declare what your identity is. This all comes back to digital rights management, because now the person that is making the identity claim is a purchaser. purchaser, I'm using the term very loosely, a purchaser is any person who wants to use a resource, whether or not they pay for it. We'll just call them that anyways. And they do the following. They retrieve the resource, they locate the resource, they retrieve the rights expression, they accept the terms of, or conditions, they may make a payment, and then they access the resource. That's what makes a person a purchaser. Now, the locating resources is key to this, because, again, authentication and identification is about motivation, which means that digital rights is about motivation. And so putting the digital rights mechanism, embedding it with the mechanism that allows you to locate resources, is a very powerful means of increasing motivation. And it's been argued that the reason why people used sites like all of MP3 or MP3.com or even Nutella or Napster or whatever wasn't because they could get free music. It was because it was so much easier to get music there than through any of the official sources. And even today, it's a real pain to actually buy music online. And any time a search service comes up that allows access to music, it's much easier to use that search service. Even today, I don't know of a single service that allows me to find any music whatsoever on the internet. It's always, you know, this distributor, this artist, or this record label, or whatever. Allowing people, putting the search system, creating the search system in such a way that's compliant with the DRM system, allows people to search for and retrieve listings based not simply on the nature of the resource itself, but also on the rights qualities. Yahoo and Google, for example, both allow a Creative Commons search. So you can search the internet for materials that are free to use, free to put in your webpage or whatever. Flickr as well has a Creative Commons image search. And so you can search for images based on the Creative Commons license that it has. We will also see purchaser brokers, and we're beginning to see these already, sites like Amazon and others. The purchaser broker acts as a representative for the purchaser, and you would make your request for rights metadata, and you would make your payment via the purchaser broker. And then the purchaser broker would transport the key or transport the ticket from the vendor to the purchaser. And the idea here is that instead of paying this site, that site, the other site, whatever site, for purchases of individual items, you make your payment through the purchaser, and then you just pay your purchaser broker for your purchases rather than all these other sites willy-nilly. You might ask, well, why would you really want to do that, especially if you don't really buy a whole lot? And basically, it comes down to this. Your purchaser broker might be located in your own town, and the vendor might be located in Russia. And where would you rather pay? Would you rather pay somebody downtown or somebody in Russia? Where would you rather send your credit card information, somebody downtown or somebody in Russia? Because the purchaser broker not only aggregates purchases, it also localizes them so that the financial relationship is something that you're going to have a greater degree of trust over. And this is the part, when people talk about DRM, trusted computing, and all of that, this is the part that they always miss. And it's the part where the consumer doesn't really trust the vendor any more than the vendor trusts the computer. The vendor always is saying, oh yeah, we're so trustworthy. You can pay us. We're the RIAA. You can give us all of your information. But consumers, especially recently, are beginning to get more and more skeptical about that. You buy a single CD and you're deluged with spam for the rest of your life. And people are noticing this. This takes us to the last section, it's the section I'm going to talk about least, because I'm really not that interested in it, but other people are. And that's the protection, and in particular, resource-based protection. And basically, all I have to say about it is, first of all, it exists. Microsoft Word might require a password to open a document. I've got documents that I can't ever read because I've forgotten the password. PDF has ways of locking documents for that really annoying feature that prevents you from cutting and pasting the contents. DVDs, for example, have the CSS copy protection system. And these systems even have enjoyed legislative support recently. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act in the United States, for example, prohibits the breaking of any of these protection mechanisms. And according to the article I read in the paper this morning, the legislation currently being considered in Canada would propose much the same thing. And of course, there are problems with this copy protection mechanism, use protection mechanism. And first of all, typically it doesn't really protect the content. Take the DVD CSS protection, for example. There's a guy called DVD John. He's based, I believe it's in Finland, who's written the algorithm that cracks that. And in fact, for any copy protection system, there's always going to be a way of breaking that copy protection system. And this was stated most famously in the Microsoft Black Web paper, and I give you the link there. And if you think about it, this has to be true, because any resource that's copy protected has to be played at some point. Otherwise, there's no point, right? And if the resource can be played, then it follows that the copy protection scheme can be broken. Because if it was unbreakable, it would never be playable. And even further, there's the thing called the analog gap. The analog gap is basically the simple fact that your content at some point has to go from the computer to the human. And in going from the computer to the human, humans are not digital devices. That means that sound must actually be produced as sound waves in the air. Images must actually be visible as light waves in the air. And as the information is crossing this analog gap, it can be recorded. I may have a sound file that I just simply cannot crack through any other means. But the minute I play it, now I can crack it. I'm recording this talk with my iRiver. I can record any sound with my iRiver, any sound whatsoever. What's going to stop me? It's analog. DRM isn't going to work. The argument is that protection creates proprietary content monopolies. That the point of DRM protection isn't so much to protect the content, which it doesn't, rather it's to force people to use a certain brand of technology. The DRM associated with iTunes, for example, forces people to buy Apple equipment. You can't just go out and buy some clones. That's why I use an iRiver, because it records an MP3. And MP3 is not a protected format, so I can share it. The thing with protected content is, in the end, it's producing all of these DRM nightmare stories. And I've drawn a bunch of examples from an issue of PC Magazine. When you're watching a video and you try to fast forward past the commercial and it refuses to let you do that. Or when you insert a CD into the CD drive and the CD doesn't play and it crashes your computer and it locks your CD drive. Or if you spend all that time filling out your tax return and you go to print it, the computer demands more money. Or if there's a broadcast flag in a television program that prevents your TiVo or your video recorder from recording the program so you can watch it later. Or if you're reading an ebook and you can't print out a chapter even if the chapter's in public domain. All of these things are the annoyances that copy protection causes. So my own recommendation is, forget the copy protection. My own recommendation is, if you understand that digital rights is based on authentication and authentication is based on motivation, then digital rights is based on motivation. And I've always gone with the slogan, making content easier to buy than it is to steal. And that's why setting up a mechanism with the brokers like this, setting up a mechanism where the rights expression is part and parcel of the search, and setting up a mechanism where access can be seamless and painless, this will create a mechanism in which digital rights are respected, and in which all you need to do is digital rights expression in order to accomplish digital rights management. That's essentially what I had to say about DRM, and I'm going to pause here to see if there's comments or questions. Works for me. Okay, so we're taking a 10-minute break, and I'm going to shut this down.